I was able to wonder, think about what I wanted to say in a brief introduction about Mike, because I figured it should be brief because almost everyone here is here because they know of his work, which is important work. But these thoughts came to me over the last 3 days while I was rereading City of Quartz on a trip to South Dakota. It's a part of South Dakota where, in some places, you can see the entire horizon, 360 degrees, which is a rare experience for me, I'd imagine for anyone. What I thought about and what I think about when I'm there or places like that is that my optimism and open-mindedness is in proportion to the distance between buildings and the amount of horizon that I'm able to see. So while reading the book, I was in quite a good mood, which often I am, even when I'm in Los Angeles, after I've had a conversation with Mike. Mike Davis, a native son of Southern California, born in Fontana, raised in a section of eastern, I guess east of San Diego, a place called Bostonia. He's known by trade as an urban theorist, a teacher, and what I would consider to be a practitioner. He's done many other things, which has led him here. He describes what he sees, the outcome. He tells you how it got to be that way, the process. And he explains how it fits into and operates in a much broader context, the cosmology. Woven through all of this, he evaluates it in reasonable but obviously subjective terms. What doesn't work? What isn't fair or just? And what needs changing? Generally, his subject is human existence. Specifically, it's the city and its community. The city is his zone of action, how it forms and how it transforms, and why. He studies and dissects the sources of power, both natural and artificial. He analyzes how constructed realities of our artificial world overlay and interact with the natural world. The search and the research is for equilibrium. It's not only a question of intelligence or power. It's not an issue of capability. Rather, it's an issue of awareness. Awareness of interdependence and reciprocity between one thing and everything else. An ecology of mind, as Gregory Bateson called it, and as Black Elk spoke about it. It's a question of spirit. The world we have constructed is out of balance within itself and with nature. Mike Davis knows this. He is motivated, I believe, in the possibility of a total ecology of existence. No small task. He is constantly working towards that possibility. One place he does this work is here at SciArc, where he's been teaching for the last 8 years. Teaching by example. With exactitude, intelligence, and passion, he inspires and activates all that listen with an open mind. I've always admired one particular trait. Even when he's confronted with events that are angering, he remains calm and is able to be with good spirit. We are honored to have him among us. Please welcome Mike Davis.
Well, Let me try and set the mood first for tonight's talk by recalling the events of January and March of this year. Because every decade, maybe sometimes twice a decade, Hawaii sends Los Angeles a big wet kiss, sweeping far south of its usual path. The westerly jet stream hijacks water-laden tropical air from the Hawaiian archipelago and hurls it toward the Southern California coast. This Kona storm system, or as some local television weather reporters call it, the Pineapple Express, can carry as much as several cubic kilometers of water, or the equivalent of half of Los Angeles's annual precipitation. And when the billowing dark turbulence of the storm front collides with the high mountain wall surrounding Los Angeles, it sometimes produces rainfall of a ferocity that's unrivaled anywhere on the earth, even in the monsoonal, tropical monsoon belts. And indeed, Los Angeles area has held at various times the world record for the most rain in 1 minute, 5 minutes, and 1 hour. So the two-week-long Kona storm, which we experienced last January, differed little from the classic pattern, except perhaps in the unusual intensity of rainfall in the South Bay area, forcing the evacuation of some of the low-lying neighborhoods in Long Beach, Carson, Torrance, and Hawaiian Gardens. Otherwise, the scenes were those of an ordinary, familiar disaster. Power was cut to tens of thousands of homes. Sinkholes mysteriously appeared in front yards. Pet animals and several children were sucked into the deadly vortices of the flood channels. Reckless motorists were drowned in flooded intersections. Lifeguards had to rescue shoppers in downtown Laguna Beach, and million-dollar homes tobogganed off their hillside perches. Quite an ordinary disaster. What was exceptional was not the storm itself, merely a 20-year event, according to meteorologists, but the way in which it was instantly assimilated to other disasters as a malevolent omen. There's a growing popular apprehension that the land of sunshine is reinventing itself, to use a fashionable gerund, as a Book of Apocalypse theme park. In less than 3 years, the megalopolis has endured 3 of the 10 most costly domestic disasters since the Civil War. The fierce February 1992, January 1993, and January and March 1995 storms, which have caused almost $500 million damage, were mere brackets around the April 1992 insurrection, $1 billion damage, the October-November 1993 firestorms, $1 billion damage, and, of course, the great Northridge earthquake in January 94, the total cost of which is yet to be calculated but will exceed $20 billion and is the most costly natural disaster in American history. From Ventura to Laguna and all stops in between, at least 1 million Southern Californians have been directly touched by disaster-related death, injury, or damage to their homes and businesses. This virtually biblical conjunction of disaster is unique in American history, and it's purchased thousands of one-way tickets to Seattle, Portland, and Santa Fe. After a century of population influx, there's now a net exodus out of Southern California. Middle-class apprehensions about the angry, abandoned underclasses are only exceeded by anxieties about blind thrust faults and 100-year floods. Meanwhile, Caltech seismologists warn that the Pacific Rim is only beginning its long overdue rock and roll. Kobe may be a 3D postcard of Los Angeles 2000, and waiting in the wings are the locusts and the killer bees. This is no exaggeration. Locusts frequently followed droughts in the 19th century, and the killer bees just crossed the border into California. It is unclear whether this vicious circle of disaster is coincidental or eschatological. Could this be merely what nonlinear statisticians wave away as the Joseph effect of fractal geometry, the common clustering of catastrophe? Or are these the last days, as prefigured so often in the genre of LA disaster fiction and film, from the Day of the Locust to Earthquake in Wilshire Boulevard? Either way, Mandelbrot or Nathaniel West, millions of Angelenos have become genuinely terrified of their environment. Paranoia about nature, of course, distracts attention from the obvious fact that Los Angeles has deliberately put itself in harm's way. For generations, market-driven urbanization has transgressed environmental common sense. Historic wildfire corridors have been turned into view lot suburbs, wetland liquefaction zones into marinas, and floodplains into industrial districts and housing tracts. Monolithic public works have been substituted for regional planning and a responsible land ethic. As a result, Southern California has reaped flood, fire, and earthquake tragedies that were as avoidable and unnatural as the beating of Rodney King and the ensuing explosion in the streets. But the social construction of natural disaster is largely hidden from view by a perverse ideology that simultaneously imposes false categories and expectations on the environment and then explains the inevitable discrepancies as proof of a malign and hostile nature. Pseudoscience in the service of rampant greed has militarized Anglo-American perceptions of the regional landscape. Southern California, in the most profound sense, suffers a crisis of identity. No belief, for instance, is more deeply rooted than the conviction that Los Angeles would be Death Valley, except for the great aqueducts that transfer the stolen snowmelt of the Sierras and the Rockies to its lawns and pools. The city is advertised as the triumph of super engineers like William Mulholland, who built rivers in the deserts. A corollary of this Promethean claim, of course, is the idea that beneath the artificial landscape, there's something sinister and barren, incapable of sustaining even a tiny fraction of the current multitudes. Yet Los Angeles County, while semi-arid, is no more desert than Murcia or the Côte d'Azur, which have the same annual rainfall. Technology and concrete have alienated any clear view of its natural history. In contrast, the first written descriptions of the region, the 18th century diaries of the Franciscan Padres, Fathers Font, Palou, Garza, and Crespi, eulogized the waterscapes and natural fertility. Quote, "All the soil is black and loamy and is capable of producing every kind of grain and fruit which may be planted," Father Juan Crespi wrote in 1769. "We went west, continually over good land, well covered with grass. All the land we saw this morning seemed admirable to us." The diaries of Father Francisco Palou and Pedro Font also extolled the abundant springs, the cienagas, the beautiful rivers, valleys green and flowers strewn. After crossing the true deserts of Sonora and Antigua, California, these Mediterranean men, and all the Franciscans were Mallorcans, were delighted by the familiar oak savannas and, quote, "the infinity of wild rose bushes in full bloom." From their cultural perspective, it was a land well watered. The Anglo-American conquistadors, three-quarters of a century later, however, were riven by confusion and ambivalence. Boosterism coexisted with an almost irrational fear of aridity, and there were great debates during the 1850s and 1860s whether California as a whole was an Eden or worthless desolation. Yankee morale tended to wax and wane with the cycle of wet and dry years. Settlers found it almost impossible to form a consistent picture of the intermittent climate or the protean landscape. In the most fundamental sense, language and cultural inheritance failed the newcomers. English terminology, specific to humid climate, was incapable of describing the dialectic of water and drought that shaped Mediterranean environments. By no stretch of the imagination, for instance, is an arroyo merely a glen or a hollow. They're the results of radically different hydrological processes. Arroyos, to be exact, are studied via cusp catastrophe models, while tempered glens and hollows are analyzed via traditional stream channel models. So the Anglos were forced to preserve the more accurate Spanish terms without really appreciating their larger environmental context. And it was not until the discovery of the great artesianal basins, millions of acre feet of subterranean water during the 1870s, and the subsequent growth of the citrus industry, that a luxuriant stereotype of Southern California became possible. Even then, there was the initial mistake of advertising Southern California as semi-tropical. And of course, as Easterners thought about the idea of semi-tropical, they began to see green snakes coiled and trees and swamps, and a sinister image. So ultimately, the railroad publicists and the Chamber of Commerce promoters repackaged Southern California as our Italy. For more than a century, this Mediterranean metaphor has been sprinkled like cheap perfume over hundreds of instant subdivisions, It has created a faux landscape celebrating a fictional history from which original Indian and Mexican ancestors have been censored. And its dismal nadir is probably southern Orange County, with the endlessly regimented rows of identical red tile townhouses, a kind of affluent version of architectural Stalinism, are all located on cul-de-sacs called Avenida Sevilla or Via Capri. This specious Mediterranean facade is actively obstructed the recognition of the manifold and profound kinship between Southern California and the other mid-latitude regions of hot, dry summers and mild, wet winters, central Chile, the classical Mediterranean basin, part of Cape Province, and western and southern Australia. Comprising but 3 to 5% of the Earth's land surface, these Mediterranean littorals are the rarest of major environmental systems. Although the 19th century pioneer of biogeography, modern plant geography, Andreas Schimper, had marveled at the morphological similarities of their flora, serious comparative research between the Mediterranean lands waited generations until the launching of the International Biological Program with financing from the National Science Foundation in the late 1960s. And thanks to these grants, hundreds of scientists in California, Chile, Italy, France, Israel, South Africa, and Australia were organized into unprecedented and continuing collaborations. A preliminary synthesis of their research, concentrating on the structural characteristics of Mediterranean vegetation, was presented at the first international conference of Mediterranean-type ecosystems. This is a body called Medicus, in Valdivia, Chile, in 1973. Subsequent Medicus conferences have been organized around themes of fire ecology, biological invasions, role of nutrients, biotic resilience, landscape management, and most recently, biodiversity. The cumulative impact of this research, now coordinated by the Mediterranean Ecological Society, has been the revelation of what we might call the deep structures of Mediterraneity, based on the complex interaction of biological and landscape evolution with climate. We now know, for example, that there's been a spectacular convergence of plant evolution in each region, as communities of different origins have adopted virtually identical strategies, above all, Scirophily, to deal with the stress of summer drought. Comparative research has also revealed the profound ways in which Aboriginal human societies have modified each Mediterranean ecosystem through the technology of fire. Hunter-gatherer societies were once seen as having almost no control over their environments or local nature. We now appreciate that groups like the Native Australians and the Native Californians were in fact fire farmers capable of creating, you know, enormous and long-lasting changes in their landscapes. In fact, in both Australia and Southern California, it's almost impossible to know what elements or components of the original landscape at contact was not created or in some way structured by human beings, and particularly by fire. Now, the Franciscans were intimately familiar with the dramatic landscape metabolism of the classical Mediterranean, so they were not shocked to discover similar cataclysmic cycles at work in Alta California. They found abundant evidence, for example, of recent great floods, and while camped on the banks of the lovely Rio Porcioncula, or the LA River, both Fathers Crespi and Palou experienced violent earthquakes. Reasoning on the analogy of southern Italy and the local abundance of asphaltum, or Brea, Palou speculated matter-of-factly that there were probably volcanoes here as well. But the hucksters of the 1880s who franchised Mediterranean California were selling sunshine, not earthquakes and deluges. Immigrants from the human states, moreover, brought with them deeply ingrained prejudices about climate and landscape that had been shaped by the environmental continuum of northwestern Europe and northeastern North America. In these temperate and forested lands, energy flows through the environment in an annually predictable seasonal pattern. Geology is generally quiescent, and natural powers are perceived as orderly and incremental, rarely catastrophic. The landscape seems generally in equilibrium with the vector of forces acting upon it. Indeed, the canonical evocations of the English and New England countrysides, the Reverend Gilbert White's Natural History of Selborne, written in 1788, And, of course, Henry David Thoreau's Walden, written in 1854, were microcosmic celebrations of nature's gentle balance, even, of course, as Thoreau was sounding a tocsin against the ecological threat of the Industrial Revolution. This culturally relative and geographically specific view of natural process, resonant with what American naturalist John Burroughs called the pastoral quiet and sweetness and harmony of the English landscape, was transformed by Darwin's mentor, Sir Charles Lyell, into one of the great dogmas of Victorian science. Sir Charles Lyell is a figure somewhat forgotten today, but he's the shoulders on which Darwin climbed his three-volume Principles of Geology, open to the 19th century, a vision of deep time, not just biblical time of 5,863 years, but eons, tens and hundreds of millions of years long. One of the most revolutionary changes in human consciousness in the 19th century. But as both Martin Ruddock and Stephen Jay Gould have shown, Lyell's famous principle of uniformitarianism conflated the constancy of natural laws, a methodological axiom, with uniformities of rate and state, substantive claims. He believed that large-scale surface features were the result, quote, of insensible changes added through vast times, and that the Earth was a conservative, steady-state system without historical directionality. The moderate Whig, Lyell, waged ceaseless philosophical warfare against opposing tectonic model, which was most popular in France and Germany, of Earth revolutions. Catastrophism, whether biblical or Jacobin, was branded by Lyell and by Darwin as pre-scientific superstition. Now, I would argue that a doggedly uniformitarianism mindset, which we might also call the humid fallacy, still conditions most environmental expectations in Southern California. Imaginary norms and averages are constantly invoked as standards. The weather, for instance, is always berated for its perversity, as in, well, we've had an unusually wet season or dry season, or the weather isn't like it used to be. And despite the daily reminders that we live in earthquake country, every high-intensity natural event, quake, flood, fire, Santa Ana wind, landslide, produces new shock and consternation. As one day's survivor of the Northridge earthquake told the television crew, I feel like nature has let us down. Yet Southern California, at least by Lyellian standards, is a revolutionary, not a reformist landscape. This is Walden Pond on LSD. As in other Mediterranean and dryland environments, the average is merely an abstraction. Nothing is less likely to occur in Southern California than annual average rainfall. At City Hall, where annual precipitation is pegged at 15.3 inches, the mark has been hit only twice in the 127-year history of measured rainfall. Now, if you live in New England or Pennsylvania or Suffolk or Flanders, the average rainfall is actually a norm. And in any given year, your rainfall probably comes within a few inches of it. Nothing is more unlikely here. The actual norm is a 7 to 12-year oscillation between dry and humid periods. And sometimes the annual average is delivered during a single 2-week Kona storm sequence. Other times it may take 2 or even 3 drought years to achieve the same total. Likewise, in tranquil Hampshire or Massachusetts, rivers may swell to flood with a mere doubling of their normal flow. In Southern California, on the other hand, the Los Angeles River, metamorphizing from a trickle of sewage, has been known to increase its flow 3,000-fold in a single 24-hour period. Local erosion and sedimentation rates also accelerate explosively. Fluvial environments in the Mediterranean basin, as in the arid American Southwest, behave in the same way. Environmental fluctuations, in other words, tend toward the exponential, which is why geomorphologists working in Israel and California have so eagerly adopted catastrophe theory as a framework for understanding landscape processes. Indeed, nothing so distinguishes Southern California from classical Anglo-American environments as the contrasting role of extreme events or catastrophes. Research has generally supported Lyellian's stereotype that low or moderate intensity, high frequency events orchestrated in a seasonal cycle perform most geomorphic work in low altitude temperate environments. The English parson looking out at the robin on the tree, the raindrops falling, the seasons changing, everything reliable, consistent, the wonders of subtle change over great periods of time, et cetera, et cetera. I mean, these are the cliches of that classical Anglo-American landscape. The opposite, however, is the case in Mediterranean and desert regions. Here, change is concentrated into short episodes, the equivalent of punctuated equilibrium in modern neo-Darwinism that inaugurate new steady states. High-intensity, low-frequency events, what we call disasters, are simply the ordinary agents of landscape and ecological change. For example, if sedimentation, the physical mass of erosion, is taken as an index of geomorphic work, then, quote, the bulk of the total sediment discharged into the coastal basins of Southern California during a 50-year period of stream gauging from 1930 to 1980 was, quote, delivered in a few days during the great floods of 1938 and 1969. These were the two so-called 100-year storm events in the 20th century. Furthermore, the extreme events that shaped the Southern California environment tend to be organized in surprising and powerfully coupled causal chains. Drought, for example, dries fuel for wildfires, which in turn remove ground cover and make soils impermeable to rain. Earthquakes may have already created new erosion surfaces and increased stream power by elevation change. In such conditions, storms produce sheet flooding, landscapes, and debris flows that result in dramatic erosion and landscape change. Vast volumes of sediment realign river channels, and before the advent of 20th century flood control engineering, even switch river courses between alternative deltas. Some of you know that in some epochs, the LA River drained into the Pacific through Bologna Creek, creating the immense sand dunes of El Segundo. At other periods, it switched back to San Pedro Bay, back and forth over thousands of years. Sedimentation also created sandbars that temporarily cut off tidal flow to coastal marshes, initiating in turn a 50 to 75 year cycle of ecological readjustment. This is not random disorder, but a hugely complicated system of positive and negative feedback loops, geomorphic and biological, that channel powerful pulses of climatic or tectonic energy, disasters, into environmental work. The outcomes, however, are radically unpredictable. The Southern California environment exemplifies the nonlinear rules of deterministic chaos, governed by both probabilistic and deterministic elements. In such systems, entropy, and I mean entropy in the mathematical, not in the thermodynamic sense, or entropy in the sense of information theory, measures the relative degree of unpredictability or range of possible states. Southern California, accordingly, might be described as having high landscape entropy, a high degree of uncertainty as to the outcome of any environmental event, which means that no environmental event simply repeats itself in a cycle. In other words, this is a historical landscape where each major event restructures the system in the context in which it occurs. Each is unique. Similarly, physical environments can be distinguished by the extent to which they retain surficial expressions of their past history, once again as compared with the humid cratonic zones. Mediterranean and dryland environments preserve events of great magnitude over longer periods of time. In other words, they have greater landscape memory. More of the past is visibly fossilized in the present. Present processes, conversely, overprint paleoforms and complex pathosets. And so, for instance, if you live where I do, in Pasadena, at the alluvial foot of the San Gabriel Mountains, it's extremely difficult to distinguish some of the landslides and debris of the floods of this January or March from landslides and debris that are from a great Pleistocene earthquake, landslide, that occurred 12 to 15,000 years ago. This temporal and structural complexity of landforms in turn contributes to the relatively greater spatial heterogeneity and thus biotic diversity of Mediterranean environments. As one of my heroes, Stephen Pine, who's just finishing writing his epic five-volume history of fire and earth, points out in his history of fire in Southern California, He says, the complex physical geography of Mediterranean landscapes makes possible a complex geography of life, the mosaic of microclimates sustaining a mosaic of microbiotas. The biodiversity of Mediterranean regions is second only to tropical rainforests. California alone has more than 5,000 native plants, about half of them endemic. And as you probably know, Mediterranean cities or Mediterranean regions tend to have a staggering diversity of microclimates. In July, one day in July, the LA Times reported that it was 112 degrees in Woodland Hills and 72 degrees at Venice Beach. I mean, where else in the world can you have a 40-degree difference in temperature in a single city? Finally, landscape and biome have co-evolved. Each of the ecosystems comprising the original biological mosaic of the Los Angeles region was evolutionarily adapted to conditions of high entropy and periodic convulsion. And if you think I'm using complicated terminology, the Israeli landscape ecologist Zev Navev, who I like to read, describes Mediterranean environments as perturbation-dependent homeoretic ecosystems. Chaparral and oak savannas, for example, depend on wildflower to recycle nitrogen and ensure seed germination. And at least before dam building, floods periodically redistributed niches for aboriginal grasslands and riparian forests. This is a really big problem for people involved in management or restoration of environmental systems or ecosystems, because all this depends on having some baseline, some original state, some climax form, some mature stage of the ecosystem. But in fact, the very characteristic of a Mediterranean ecosystem is that it's constantly in disequilibrium. It's constantly in flux or evolution. Coastal salt marshes, like the one we're standing on right now, were the products of cataclysm. Their whole metabolism was to be periodically inundated, destroyed, constantly readjusting, inundated again. How do you describe the original condition? There is no equilibrium or starting point. Some researchers, it should be added, are trying to use complexity theory to model the behavior of high-energy Mediterranean environments as nonlinear dynamical systems. But if Ilya Pirogin and the Santa Fe Institute provide a framework for thinking about chaotic dynamics, then so does Prophet John of the Book of Revelations. There's an interesting irony in the mismatch of Lyell's paradigm with Southern California. The 19th century uniformitarians fought biblical literalism in the name of deistic rationalism. Yet the Bible is superb environmental literature. In particular, it contains rich encyclopedic descriptions of Eastern Mediterranean landscape ecology that are far more appropriate to Southern California than the Arcadian idols of Walden or the natural history of Selborne. In particular, the Bible has very convincing accounts of the role of catastrophe in Mediterranean history. Now I move to the sexy stuff. The need for a new environmental epistemology is most evident in any discussion of the massive single-purpose infrastructures that supposedly leash nature to the will of Los Angeles. As John McPhee has pointed out so eloquently in The Control of Nature, the struggle between human and natural wills is totally one-sided. Bureaucratic faith in the immortality of public works derives exclusively from attenuated, almost meaningless official time frames. In effect, we think ourselves gods upon the land, but are at most mere tourists. Our historical memory, to begin with, is simply too short to measure the rhythms of ecological time. If the average human lifetime is defined as 62 years, the native Californian culture spent at least 142 lifetimes accumulating sacred and reliable environmental knowledge. In contrast, Anglo-Americans have occupied this region for little more than 2.5 lifetimes. Most of the major water, flood control, sewerage, energy, communication, and transportation systems are less than one lifetime old. If there's been a single fatal flaw in the design of Southern California as a civilization, it has been the decision to base the safety of present and future generations almost entirely upon short-sighted extrapolations from the disaster record of the last half century. For example, the region's multi-billion-dollar flood control system was built to control a statistical abstraction known as the 100-year flood, in effect the great 1938 flood, which reoccurred on the same scale in 1969. But how would storm channels, debris basins, and dams stand up to an event like the 200-year Noah deluge of 1861-1862, which involved at least three times the greater volume of water and transformed most of coastal Los Angeles and Orange counties into a vast inland sea? You could have rowed, by the way, from downtown to Newport Beach along the present route of I-5. Equally, what would happen if the dread Churubuscos, the Churubuscos are tropical hurricanes, from the coast of southern Mexico, which were so frequent in the 19th century but have been rare in the 20th century, with only three Churubuscos who crossed the coast of this century. What if they again became more frequent? Similarly, everyone knows that a great earthquake along the San Bernardino Mountains or Coachella Valley segments of the southern San Andreas Fault, something comparable to the Fort Tejon event of 1857, which was an 8.0 magnitude, something like this is statistically overdue. Yet seismic safety legislation consists almost entirely of grudging a posteriori responses to smaller 20th century earthquakes like Long Beach in 1933, which was 6.3, San Fernando in 1971, 6.6. Moreover, last year's Northridge catastrophe, a moderate earthquake, a mere 6.7, radically revised disaster planning by demonstrating the incredible damage that could be caused by a moderate quake. As a result, it is now estimated that the inevitable 1,000 times more powerful quake along the northern or eastern San Andreas edge in the megalopolis could cause $140 to $200 billion in property damage. The same revision applied to the repeat of the great 1923 Kano earthquake in Tokyo would involve at least $1 trillion damage by current estimates. Relative to obvious potential hazards, in other words, modern Los Angeles has been capitalized on sheer gambler's luck. And the cycle of actual disaster has been serendipitously tuned to the same frequency as the business cycle. The most damaging 20th century floods and earthquakes have coincided, excepting the 1987 Whittier quake, with recession or slow growth years. Incredibly, there were no ordinary disasters during the great booms of 1919 to 29, 1945 to 68. Cataclysm, apart from the moderate 1987 Whittier Narrows earthquake, 5.9, has never interrupted a major business expansion, but has offered providential excuses for Keynesian counter-cyclical spending during recessions, most notably in 1934, 1938, and 1994. Indeed, one of these disasters had a most happy architectural consequence. The March 10th, 1933 Long Beach earthquake destroyed thousands of structures roughly along an axis of Long Beach Boulevard from Huntington Park to downtown Long Beach. It also destroyed almost in its entirety the business district at Compton, killed about 121 people. And of course, when the rebuilding started in 1934, the United States was in the deepest winter of the Depression. Okay? Banks had just, you know, been closed by the incoming administration. Nobody was building anything except in Southern California. This was the only building boom in America in 1934, thanks to the earthquake. And it just so happened that a movie that had just come out, Grand Hotel, had popularized a new style of design, Art Deco. So as a happy result of the 1933 earthquake, which I called in a seminar we did here at SciArc, the Great Deco Earthquake, you have the greatest concentration of vernacular, ordinary Deco architecture in the world, precisely along the line of the 1933 earthquake. You can think about LA's advantages in disaster in other ways as well. Obviously, the 1906 San Francisco earthquake was an important factor in Los Angeles's early 20th century competition with the city that had once been the queen of the Pacific. The two murderous hurricanes, I believe in 1926 and 1928 in South Florida, put an abrupt end to the Florida boom for more than a generation and removed South Florida temporarily as a competitive factor with Southern California. By contrast, you can imagine how the history of Southern California might have been slightly different if its modern image had been shaped by experiences like the thousands of tourists who perished in the great deluge of 1921, were swallowed in the great quake of 1963, as Gidget and all of her friends were sucked down into the Newport Inglewood Fault. However, the historical record beginning in 1769 and largely anecdotal before 1880 scarcely hints at the real environmental anomaly of 20th century Los Angeles. Only in the last few years has it become possible, via the decoding of new archives of climate and neotectonic history, ranging from undersea turbidity deposits and barb deposits in the Santa Barbara Channel to pack rat mittens, even the bacterial scrim on desert rocks, we have suddenly in the last decade achieved huge new powers of revolution and insight into the environmental history of the last several millennia, and we're able to recontextualize recent history. It has been an astonishing revelation. Scott Stein, recent study, Scott Stein's a geographer at Cal State Hayward, who spent most of the last 5 years waist-deep in freezing cold ponds and lakes in the Sierras looking at dead tree trunks, most of them about 800 or 900 years old, sitting in the middle of what are now lakes and ponds. His recent study of relic tree trunks, and this has been sensational in the science press, indicates that the last century was the third wettest period in California in 3,500 years. Similarly, an earlier tree ring analysis in the 80s of precipitation trends in western forests showed that the current water allocation under the Colorado Compact, which was based on a very tiny record, 1907-1932, of anomalously high persistent runoff, the tree ring analysis shows that this was the greatest and longest such anomaly in the last 450 years. That is, it was the wettest single period in the last 450 years. Other researchers have pointed to the unusually low variability of rainfall in the 20th century. To quote from one study, the modern California record differs from the longer period of the Reconstruction in that the frequency of wet years and extremely dry years has been lower. This has led to one of the lowest rates for extreme events in the last 600 years. In other words, we have lived through a mild climate anomaly. And this has been accompanied, in turn, by unusual seismic quiescence, what is formally known as the moment deficit paradox. Quite simply, recent geodetic surveys, as well as trench section studies of active faults, indicate an earthquake frequency in the Los Angeles basin over the last several millennia that is dramatically higher than the record of the last two centuries. Too few quakes have been taking place to relieve the accumulation of strike slip and compressional strain generated by plate tectonic motion as Los Angeles is borne northward toward Alaska. And the most dramatic revelation of this was the work done last year, or actually completed this year, by this huge research team led by James Dolan, who was at Caltech, is now at USC. And they tried to quantify this historical earthquake deficit and propose two possible scenarios. And I quote from them. In the first scenario, strain is released in numerous moderate Northridge-like earthquakes. In the second, strain is released in less frequent but much larger, magnitude 7.2 to 7.6 earthquakes. It's been at least 210 years since one of these extreme earthquakes has occurred in the region. And they also say that 17 moderate earthquakes should have occurred in the last 195 years, but we've experienced only two. In other words, we're short either 15 Northridge-sized earthquakes or one 7.6 event. We're overdrawn. In the event of either scenario, a deadly swarm of Northridge-sized quakes or bigger than Loma Prieta event, and this isn't on the San Andreas, this is right under us, like the Charnock Fault up the street here a few blocks, the Dolan Group predict a scale of destruction that would, quote, certainly strain the ability of the region and the nation to absorb the resultant losses. It is important to emphasize, moreover, that they're considering seismic hazards only in the heart of the metropolis. They do not include the exurban San Andreas Fault or the San Jacinto Faults in their study. The calculation of the seismic deficit has gone hand in hand with the discovery, since the 1987 Whittier Narrows earthquake, of an ominous thicket of blind thrust faults which undergird the Santa Monica Mountains and the Elysian Hills, including downtown Los Angeles. A decade ago, seismologists talked exclusively about the big one on the San Andreas Fault. Now Caltech teams are studying more than 50 active faults that they believe are capable of producing at least Northridge-sized events in the heavily urbanized portions of Los Angeles, Orange, and Ventura counties. And my main point, the urbanization of Southern California, in other words, seems to have taken place during one of the most unusual episodes of climatic and seismic benignity since the inception of the Holocene. The urbanization of Southern California has occurred in a period with the fewest extreme climate events and with the mildest seismic activity in any of the period that we're able to decipher with much confidence or high resolution over the last 4,000 or 5,000 years. It's an utter anomaly. So what would normal climate, what would a normal seismic regime mean? Well, first of all, it's important to recognize that the new data is producing an intellectual revolution as well, because it's rapidly undermining the old epistemologies of hazard analysis and prediction. As one odd geologist put it, to quote, "This is one of those rare moments in science when your observational systems bring you something you've never seen before." Seismologists, for example, are being forced to reconsider their Pandlossian belief in the long-range predictability of characteristic earthquakes based on the study of their recurrence intervals and the identification of seismic gaps. The embarrassing failure of the 8-year-long $20 million Parkfield quake prediction experiment, together with the weird behavior of the 1992 Landers event, which did all kinds of things quakes weren't supposed to do, like hopscotching along different fault segments and producing clusters of related earthquakes as far away as Yellowstone, have created a Kuhnian paradigm crisis of the first order. As one eminent seismologist bluntly observed in the wake of the Northridge earthquake, quote, "The American earthquake prediction program is utterly shattered." Likewise, some climate historians and hydrologists, particularly those who are studying water resources in the Southwest, are in open rebellion against what one calls, quote, "the leap of logic and unscientific circularity," quote, represented by orthodox flood frequency analysis and engineering dogmas like the 100-year flood. As he says further, these words, of course, have essentially nothing to do with real years or real floods. Instead, the words represent an idealization based on often fallacious assumptions. They're an example not of science, but of insidious form of philosophical nominalism. From complexity theory, they borrow concepts of dissipated systems, fractal clustering, scale dependency, strange attractors, and tunneling. But the real thrust of their epistemological offensive, and this is something that's very infrequently pointed out in most of the popular literature, and of course obvious bias of mine as a historian, is to establish the historicity of the landscape process. In the words of one, quote, "they show that there's a regular recurrence, but except for specific periodic states, there are also elements of unpredictability, complexity, and chance events." The seismologist I quoted, actually Sina Lomitz, based in the University of Mexico, a wonderful writer and scientist, urges seismologists to replace the reliance on mechanistic periodicities with the more complex metaphor of the changing watershed, where, quote, "the drainage pattern is evolving and shifting with every successive flood. Every major event restructures the system that causes the events." USGS geologist Herbert Shaw, on the other hand, compares the new non-Newtonian hourglass to a surrealist clock marked off in unequal subdivisions, as well as to poetic time calibrated simultaneously by logic and nightmare, or by order and disorder. In any case, large-scale extreme events are envisioned as imparting unique and unpredictable trajectories to landscape evolution. The El Niño Southern Oscillation, abbreviated as ENSO, is a superb example of this directional but nonlinear and catastrophe-punctuated temporality. Solar energy stored in the tropical waters of the Western Pacific is released in coupled wind ocean current pulses, which often generate major storms in Southern California. In fact, there's a large community of archaeologists in Southern California who are interpreting the history of Native California as a series of cultural adaptations to periodic or to aperiodic subsistence crises caused by El Niño events. El Niño means an increase in warmer water, which tends to cut off the upwelling of nutrients that make the Santa Barbara Channel and the area off of Santa Monica Bay one of the richest and most productive marine ecosystems in the world. So periodically, El Niño events would not only produce floods and great erosion, they would lead to collapses in marine bioproductivity, to actual starvation. And they have correlated some of the major innovations in the history of the Chumash and the Gabrielino people to reactions to these crises. So in some ways, El Niño Southern Oscillation is the rhythm section of our erosion cycle. It's the major, you know, event, and it's a worldwide event as well as a, you know, regional one, that we can read the signal in human time and environmental time. But it keeps time like an avant-garde jazz drummer. And those of you who know about jazz drumming know that good jazz drummers use broken beats and superimposed tempos. So I'm arguing that ENSO is kind of like Elvin Jones. Overlapping and variable frequencies of atmosphere-ocean interaction produce a disconcerting syncopation that is neither regular nor random. In fact, some recent ENSO researchers call this strange periodicity the double staircase. And those of you who've read Mandelbrot know that the double staircase is an irregular staircase, any piece of which you can magnify, you can increase in size or reduce in size, and it'll look exactly like the staircase. And they call it the double staircase because it is composed of irregular steps leading to the threshold of chaos, rather like, I would imagine, the recent social history of Los Angeles as well. Meanwhile, it's unclear how or when this epistemological revolution, which is transforming geology, climatology, how this will impact on official resource and disaster planning. At the moment, there's a widening gap between science's new understanding of local environmental hazards and the inertial practice of underfunded public agencies charged with preparing for the inevitable emergencies. And I'm sure some of you are aware that the Republican majority in Congress is right now slashing the budgets for the scientific agencies that do the original research on things like global warming, you know, the San Andreas Fault, and so on. It is nonetheless urgent to reform the short-sighted practice of extrapolating from the modern anomaly to predict future events. Planning must incorporate the increasing likelihood of fractal disaster clusters as well as the probable return of events much larger in scale than the ordinary disasters the last 150 years. That is, larger than the San Andreas earthquake, larger than the 1861-62 flood. Scientists have become especially concerned with the more powerful events that occur within the bandwidth of 200 to 1,000 years. Now, many, if not most, traditional cultures, as well as great urban civilizations like China, have long historical memories capable of preserving, capturing events that occur at these frequencies, every 200 years, every 500 years, and so on. A recent, very dramatic example of how cultural memory operates to remember environmental disturbances was during the hysteria about the outbreak of this virus outbreak, Hanna virus outbreak, in the Four Corners country, the Navajo Nation. And, of course, people were freaking out. There was this panic and hysteria that the Navajo were carrying this. And they actually took pictures of people wearing gas masks with their windows rolled up, driving their Chryslers at 100 miles an hour. And heroic work by the Center for Disease Control finally established that this was a absolutely classical pattern of an epidemic which was produced by environmental change or by an extreme environmental event, which was that recent unusual El Niños had produced unusually wet years in the Colorado Plateau, which had increased the production, I think it was, of pine nuts, which these little deer mice live on. Their population had exploded, and the virus which they carry, this deadly virus, Hantavirus, which recently has been also found in, of all places, Newport Beach, suddenly had the critical mass to affect humans. But while the people from the Center for Disease Control were trying to figure out what the hell this was, they recognized that, the Navajo already had a whole pattern of behavior which regarded rodents as really, dangerous things. The Navajo do not have anything to do with rodents. Keep them outside of your home. Never touch rodents. Fear rodents. And, of course, when they discovered what the disease was, this was the most sensible and practical path to take toward this epidemic, indicating that the Navajo would probably experience similar spikes of deer mice populations and subsequent epidemics and other similar environmental events previously in their history, and they had registered and kept that event. But we, and I mean we only in the sense of Anglo-American California, does not have a historical memory or an experience that allows us to capture events on this wavelength. Now, one of these super disasters, of course, is the overdue great 7.2, 7.6 Los Angeles Basin earthquake discussed by the Dolan Research Team. Again, not the San Andreas Fault, but an earthquake of this size right within the basin. Another is the 500-year flood event identified by undersea studies of flood-caused turbidity deposits in the Santa Barbara Channel. And these, in turn, may be linked to the coupled El Niño volcanic cycle that two geoscientists at UC San Diego, Kuhn and Shepard, claim was responsible for catastrophic incidents of coastal erosion in Southern California over the last 1,000 years. But the really apocalyptic event within contemporary scientific crosshairs, and the one that is probably creating more excitement and fascination than any other discovery, and is now the traces of this, the dramatic evidence of this are now being seen all over the world, is the recurrent mega-drought that Scott Stein identified from his studies of relic tree trunks. While the longest 20th century droughts, 1928 and 34, and 1987 to 92, lasted 6 to 7 years, and remember the last drought, I mean, the state was in emergency condition. I mean, our lawns were dying, our swimming pools were empty, Civilization was on its last legs. And, droughts in the 19th century produced eco-catastrophes like in 1863, when 500,000 head of cattle died, and before they died, stripped the landscape of every piece of vegetation and turned Southern California into a virtual desert. But these were 6 or 7 year droughts. These are what, state planners and hydrologists stay at nights worrying about. But Stein identified two medieval droughts, roughly from 892 to 1112, and from 1209 to 1315, that seemed to have endured for 220 and 141 years, respectively. And he's linked the first drought, which affected the entire Pacific coast of both North and South America, to the collapse of the most advanced pre-Inca civilization in coastal Peru, and the second to the collapse of the Anasazi culture of Chaco Canyon and Mesa Verde. Since then, there's been an explosion of research linking this event to the collapse of lowland Mayan, urban culture. There's massive evidence that it produced an unparalleled environmental crisis amongst native Californians. It probably drove peoples of the Great Basin, like the Shoshonean ancestors, the Gabrielinos, put them in headlong flight toward the coast. Everywhere you can see evidence. I was at an archaeological laboratory yesterday at Cal State Northridge looking at pictures of bones dug up from a cemetery, a Chumash cemetery that's dated to this period. All of a sudden, there's a huge increase in lesions, in wounds, arrowheads embedded in people's foreheads, where there's almost no visible evidence in skeletons of an earlier period of social violence. All of a sudden, violence is epidemic, and it looks like there's a massive struggle over resources, drought. By the way, this period is known in Europe as the medieval climate optimum, and Europe was responsible for enormous prosperity, the expansion of agriculture and the peasantry, the high Middle Ages, Baroque cathedrals, Notre Dame, Chartres are the results of this climate period in Europe. But in other parts of the world, like along the Pacific coast, it was disastrous. These mega droughts, moreover, were punctuated by an interval of intense humidity and recurrent flooding. To quote Stein, the medieval period in California was thus marked not only by severe and prolonged drought, but by abrupt and extreme hydroclimatic shifts from inordinate dryness to inordinate wetness and back again. Climatologists are well aware that the return of this anasazi scenario might undermine the very foundations of capitalist hydraulic civilization in Southern California and the Southwest. Unfortunately, its likelihood is only increased by contemporary global warming. And indeed, scientists are using this medieval period as a kind of analog for examining what global warming may do, although it should be pointed out that there's no evidence at all of an increase in carbon dioxide in the atmosphere, the greenhouse effect, during this medieval rise in world temperature by about 1 degree centigrade. They actually don't understand how it happened, or, for that matter, if it is in any sense part of some cycle. But global warming, which the leading scientific body responsible for studying global warming has just produced a document not yet officially released, but the New York Times managed to get a copy of it off the internet, and they've now come to the official conclusion that global warming has begun. Let me quote from one researcher: as global climate models become increasingly realistic, their mathematical results consistently point to a more hazardous world in the future. Ironically, a warmer global climate will ensure a greater frequency of both extreme drought and extreme flood conditions. Some researchers, to be sure, believe that the mysterious persistence of El Niño warming in the Pacific over the last 4 years signals that this epical climate shift has already happened. It's also interesting to realize that 20 of the 25 most expensive insurance disasters in American history have happened in the last 10 years. Now, finally, after crossing the desert of all this, the conclusion. But metropolitan Los Angeles fatally lacks the emergency capacity. Engineers would call it redundancy, to deal with earthquake clusters or inevitable 200 or 500-year floods. The cheapest and most sensible form of redundancy, of course, would have been hazard zoning to exclude development from the most disaster-prone terrains, combined with a conservative water ethic. Time and again, prophetic voices urged the region's leaders to mitigate inevitable disaster and enhance quality of life through restricting urbanization in wetlands and floodplains. They were ignored, and as a result, there's scarcely any open space left except at the outer edges to preserve as a buffer against temperamental Mediterranean nature. In the meantime, it is unclear how Southern California will afford the escalating cost of ordinary disaster, much less the immense damage of probable mega events. The region's pharaonic public works are rapidly aging. Indeed, in some cases, their functional working lives are proving to be less than an average human lifetime. And I often take my students to Devil's Gate Dam in Pasadena, which was supposed to last for centuries, if not millennia, but after 50 years is now completely filled with debris and turned into a sand and gravel quarry. Other Army Corps of Engineers' frontline storage reservoirs, like Hanson Dam, are also nearing the end of their functional lives. As urban growth, moreover, ceaselessly replaces porous soil surface with concrete and asphalt, the flood control system loses its capacity to contain another 100-year storm event. Likewise, as Los Angeles' urban fabric continues to be extended into new floodplains, liquefaction zones, and mountain fire ecologies, the social costs of protecting private development from natural disaster are exploding. To deal with the impact of build-out urbanization in the eastern San Gabriel Valley and the western Inland Empire, the Army Corps of Engineers is spending almost $1.5 billion on new flood control works in the Los Angeles and Santa Ana River channels. In the wake of the Northridge earthquake, the California insurance industry is conducting a ruthless and, as we've seen thus far, successful campaign to shift the burden of homeowner earthquake insurance either to the public sector or to spread it amongst all homeowners. And indeed, this is happening nationally. where the insurance industry for the last 5 years has been lobbying ferociously for something called the National Natural Disaster Act, which would make the federal government the insurer of last resort, but also force homeowners everywhere in America, even in places like Vermont and the Texas Panhandle that aren't too earthquake-prone, to buy earthquake insurance. And the continuing growth of white-flight suburbs in the California Chaparral Belt is raising the public cost of fire protection to unforeseen levels. So far, the Clinton administration, mesmerized by the electoral prize of California in 1996, has been willing to spend more than $12 billion to finance the Los Angeles area's recovery from riot, fire, flood, and earthquake. But a full-fledged congressional rebellion has broken out against federal disaster aid. And originally, it was a rebellion of about 100 congressmen, both Democrats and Republicans, from the upper Midwest, who supported a resolution from Representative David Obie, who some of you may know is a liberal Democrat from Wisconsin. And Obie pointed out to California representatives on the floor of the House, he said, you know, millions of people choose to live in coastal areas and earthquake zones because of the compensating attributes of those areas. You know, you guys get the surf and the sunshines, Gidget and Disneyland. I don't see why taxpayers in the rest of the country have to subsidize this decision. And he proposed just to cut California and Florida out of federal disaster relief entirely. Let them pay for it entirely by, you know, by themselves. What's actually happened, though, in the last year and a half is a fascinating story that's hardly been told in the national media, which is, you recall, the Republicans created something called the Rescission Bill, which was to strip about $15 billion out of already approved spending as a kind of down payment on deficit reduction. Some Democrats accused them of kind of setting this aside as a cash hoard to be then given back to the upper income brackets with the proposed Republican tax cuts. But they proposed to use part of it to finance the remaining portions of aid, about $6.5 billion worth, to victims of the Northridge earthquake, and to some money for victims of Midwest floods, and finally at the end, even for the Oklahoma bombings. Okay? And after a little bit some debate about which programs would be cut, President Clinton finally signed the rescission bill, saying that this was a sterling, historic example of bipartisan cooperation, showing the programs that should and could be cut. Okay? A small little item in the press. Rescission bill seemed complicated. Even the word was unfamiliar. What in fact happened is that there's an absolutely ironclad national consensus between the leadership of both parties, at least temporarily, that federal disaster relief will continue to be provided, that it will no longer be added to the deficit. But like this last $4.5 billion for Northridge, it will come out of other social programs. What social programs were cut? Well, one of the programs that was cut was educational aid to Native American reservations around the country. Summer youth employment, including all of next summer's federal summer youth employment aid, you know, the traditional program that was started after the ghetto rebellions of the 60s, they give jobs out, but only in the summer months. That's been entirely cut. Most massively, the couple $1 billion taken out of HUD's programs for low-income and public housing. So the net result of this, and I'm sure there's probably some earthquake victims here, is without you even being aware of it, you know, you're getting disaster relief that's being financed by the destruction of social programs in the inner city, affordable housing, education, job training programs. And this is the, you know, the curious and very mean result that the poor, who are already being attacked virtually every front by the present Congress, can now expect it to be landed with the bill for future disasters. If Malibu burns again, don't worry. We'll send federal relief. Where will the money come from? Let's find some program in the barrios and ghettos, or on a Native American reservation, or in some poor rural area of Mississippi, and we'll cut it. They turned federal disaster relief essentially into a program of redistribution. Although, we're still talking about the scale in Northridge. We're not talking about the scale of the kind of mega disasters that are now predicted. And there seems to be no willingness to do that, and there remains this possibility of a kind of regional revolt against Florida and California. Now, without FEMA to provide Keynesian injections of aid, the continuing clustering of disaster, whether on ordinary or extraordinary scales, inevitably will erode many of the traditional comparative advantages of the Southern California economy. Despite, however, the wishful thinking of some deep ecologists who think Gaia would be happiest with a thin sprinkling of hunter-gatherers, megacities like Los Angeles will never simply collapse and disappear. Rather, we will simply stagger on with higher body counts and greater distress through a chain of more frequent and destructive disasters. Vital parts of the region's high-tech and tourist economies may eventually immigrate to safer ground, together with tens of thousands of more affluent residents. Aficionados of complexity theory will marvel at the nonlinear resonances of unnatural disaster and social breakdown as the golden age is superseded forever by strange new chaotic attractors. Thank you.